I've said it before in this course, and I've said it to many of my clients, that the point of decision for is the point at which reliability is created in your product. And it really comes to home when we're selecting components. Usually not the reliability engineer, but say the electrical or mechanical engineer is selecting components for your product. It's when they select the particular component and its ratings and its capabilities is when, to a large extent, the reliability impact of those decisions occur. So that's why I call it the point of decision. One of the options we have is to help the design teams, and to many regards, many designers actually enjoy having a limited portfolio to pick from. But by limiting what components are available, or the types of screws that are available, or the styles of capacitors and so on, by limiting the number of vendors, by limiting the number of SKUs or part numbers that we need to manage in inventory, and so on, besides saving the company money directly on supply chain management and inventories, it saves the design team time in investigating and exploring and selecting components. If there's really only a handful of known vendors that they should select from, that limits the number of catalogs and number of meetings and number of investigations they need to explore. Now, of course, there's going to be options and parts in times when you need to go outside of the known list of components for a particular function, but it usually is the exception rather than the rule. In organizations that I've seen that are very high reliability, is they keep a pretty tight rein on component selection, and usually by having an approved vendor list, or by very deliberately saying, use the components that we have in stock or we're using already as a very strong preference when selecting components. Now, of course, when something goes wrong or something is an issue involved, then that list needs to be updated, or that guidance back to the design team needs to be updated. But it is a pretty good way to control and manage the introduction of unknown elements into your design, especially when it's concerning the reliability performance. So I talked a little bit about the part selection, but if one of the things to keep in mind, and I don't think I've talked about it before, is this notion of derating. It's very much like the stress strength calculations that more of a mechanical engineer may do. But the same principle applies for electronics. So if I'm picking a capacitor and I need to apply typically a 5 volts across the capacitor, then the selecting a component that is able to withstand not only the 5 volts, but the 5 volts plus some margin goes a long ways towards protecting the dielectric within that capacitor from breaking down over time. So giving it a 50% derating would imply that we would need to select a capacitor that could withstand, that was rated for 10 volts. And that's what we typically would use for electrolytic and many other types of capacitors. Now, there are guidelines and rules out there, sets of rules from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, from the United States Navy, and many organizations have internally their own sets of derating rules. And it does go a long ways towards helping the designer have a guideline to pick the robust enough components and not have to worry too much about having sufficient margin on every component that they select. So, of course, though, it's always a balance, and there's some engineering judgment that comes into play. But once again, it should be an exception that we need to push that margin down a little bit, or because of space or cost or some other specific reason, but with an understanding that it increases the risk for the parts to fail under the variation of the stresses that they're actually going to see. Now, in some cases, we'll take a look at our components and our subsystems and maybe new vendors and add them to a critical to reliability list. It's not the bad boy list necessarily, but it's the ones that we want to keep a closer eye on. So maybe we see some variation in the production process that was due to parts being out of spec. And that's a signal for us to work with that supplier, that vendor, to manage and control their process. Now, what we don't want to do is, and it's really only an absolute last resort, is to set up an incoming inspection and do 100% test or some sample testing. That's expensive and generally not worth the effort. But if we can control the process and help our suppliers, in some cases, learn about SPC and actually implement it, it goes a long way for them to make more consistently, to consistently make better parts, but also for us to receive better parts. And it allows us to create products that are more likely to be reliable over time. But we also need to look at our assembly processes, the repair processes, if there's any maintenance activities, all of those kinds of things that go into making sure that we have the best possible set of components going into our products, and that all the various sources of variability that require some attention and control are added to this critical to reliability list. It's analogous to the critical to quality list. It's areas where we don't have enough margin or robustness in order for it just to be included in the product and not too much oversight. There are always, it seems, a handful of components that are going to be the source of most of our problems. In identifying them early and bringing them under control, a la SPC, it goes a long way towards helping us create a reliable product. Another element of working with your supply chain is usually very early in the process. And that's when we start laying out the basic architecture and material sets that we're going to use. Are we going to use a CMOS technology or some other, say, a gallium arsenic-based CPUs? Are we going to use high-temperature circuit boards or the basic FR4 laminates? Are we going to use plastic enclosures or metal enclosures? And some of these selections are based on engineering knowledge and so on, but some of it also is with a good understanding of the stresses and the environment of where it's going to go. The more we can contribute as reliability professionals, and usually bringing the physics of failure information, is, for example, knowing that certain polymers have a softening point that's well below their melt point, and that may significantly impact the selection of a material. Everything from color fastness to the look and feel of the enclosure goes in understanding what the customer is expecting can impact the choices we make early on that eventually will create either a reliability problem or a success. So being involved with material selection for basic architecture, the concept level of how we're going to organize and set up our materials, which key vendors we're going to work with, and coatings and paints and markings and so on, all of those elements are decisions that are going to impact reliability. So it's just another area dealing with the supply chain and all of the decisions internally of where we're going to work with the supply chain. It's got a big reliability component. So a lot of info in this section is really about awareness of where we're going to be commonly working. So here's just an odd question for you. There's been a lot of news, at least recently, about the Internet of Things. And it has the ability to impact reliability and availability. Is this going to impact your products? And if so, how? Now, we'll come back to this in a future lesson when we're going to talk about availability and maintenance type activities. But have you or your organization been involved with the Internet of Things type of approach to dealing with reliability or availability? Let me know. I'd be interested. Drop it in the forums. Next section, we're going to look at the standardization and reuse of just software. It's a little bit different than the hardware side, although I would say quite very analogous.